And now it is open for whoever.
Cindy, I move that we seal the minutes of the non-public session indefinitely.
Ann Lane, I second.
Roll call, Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagman?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so I know the other folks who are listening in are in the process of being contacted. So Danielle, can you let us know when other folks are coming back online?
Some of them are starting to come in right now.
We have to start our public
hearing. But what I'm going to do is, yes, and I'm going to mute everybody who is not a speaker. So if you did not sign in as a speaker, make sure you do.
Did I lose anybody? Hello?
Hello.
Drew?
I think we need to do a roll call.
Okay. Roll call. Now that we're back in public session, Sally Griffin?
Present.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagman?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau?
Present.
Drew Klein?
Here.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up on our agenda, which is 2 minutes away, is the public hearing. So we do have a summary of withdrawn cases from Steve Berwick. Steve, are you on? Okay, I think he's not on at this point.
I don't think Steve is on. Respond, I don't think Steve is on.
Okay.
Drew, this is Angela. I don't think he was planning. I think he thought it was pretty self-explanatory.
It is. Just ask him, does anybody have any, these are withdrawn cases that have, people asked for a hearing and then withdrew. Does anybody have any questions about that?
Nope, I'm on back.
That question is the one that was just withdrawn, the Nashua case. Is that I don't see that on here.
Yeah,
or
that's not on the list because that was withdrawn after Stephen made that list.
Okay.
I'm going to hold off on the English language proficiency standards until we get the public hearing, because I know we have several people signed up to speak. All right, I have 10 o'clock by my clock, so I'm going to go ahead and gavel in the public hearing. So we are now in public hearing for remote instruction rules, ED306.14 and ED306.18A7. We have three people, to my knowledge, that are signed up to speak, and I am going to call on them in the order that I had them listed in the email that I received. And they are Carl Ladd. So, Carl, you are up first. Are you on?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yep. So please identify yourself for the record for anybody else who might be listening, and you're up.
Good morning, Chairman Klein and members of the State Board of Education. My name is Carl Ladd, the Executive Director of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association. Thank you for taking the time and allowing me to speak this morning. I'm here to provide some comments and suggestions related to the amendments proposed for Ed Rules 306.14 and 306.18. We appreciate the consideration of flexibility offered to local school districts in the determination of the delivery of remote instruction. We support the concept of this instructional model when appropriate and or necessary, and we realize that it has its purpose and utility. The concerns and suggestions for improvements to the rules are based on a non-pandemic mindset, as these will outlast our current situation, hopefully. Regarding ED 306.14, Section A9 begins with, quote, remote instruction for all students when necessary, end quote. Is it the State Board of Education's intention that necessary will be determined by the local school district? If so, we recommend this sentence to be amended to read, the State Board of Education recommends that a procedure for remote instruction that is accessible for all students during extended periods of school closure or on a case-by-case basis, as approved by the superintendent, be developed and implemented by each school district. Another question is it the State Board of Education's intention that the districts will decide what metrics to use to determine if the, quote, academic work in the remote instruction environment is equivalent in effort and rigor to typical classroom work, end quote? If that's the intent, please ensure that it is clear and transparent. If someone else is to determine this, then that should be made clear as well. However, we recommend this being a decision of local educators and school leaders. In personalized learning environments, each teacher has the professional training and assessment data to determine what academic expectations are best suited for each individual student. Please keep in mind that there are some learning experiences that simply cannot be replicated in some remote learning environments. In addition, the management of face-to-face and remote instruction simultaneously requires two channels of instruction. Professional training will be required, and even some of our greatest educators will struggle teaching in that two-channel environment, and we're currently seeing that with some of the hybrid models in place. The concerns about student privacy issues continue to surface in districts. What happens if a student has an outburst in a class or just answers a question incorrectly and it is recorded and posted by another student or a parent on social media? Although RSA 189.68.5b allows for video recordings for instructional purposes, what are the district's liabilities in a remote learning environment that would be required per this amended rule? Another question, if an individual family chooses to access remote instruction, will the state allow districts to determine the requirements to provide notification from families and from schools and approval? For example, what notice is required? How frequently can an individual come and go from the remote world? Does there have to be an extenuating circumstance for allowability? Again, this level of flexibility, if offered too quickly and without professional training and deliberate and ongoing communication to families, will certainly add to the burden on school staff, disruption to student classroom dynamics and routines, and potentially a change in working conditions. Please be mindful that a dual system of instruction occurring in one classroom may be very difficult for some students, even as it may benefit others. We'd like to suggest the following as a replacement sentence for 9B. Procedures outlining the allowability and accessibility of remote instruction. The procedure shall include the requirement for any student family who chooses remote instruction to commit to the locally established terms of instruction. Finally, there was much discussion at the May State Board of Education meeting that focused on students being able to access remote instruction if they have disabilities or even if they have the flu. Please note that districts are responsible for implementing 504 plans, which could certainly include remote instruction opportunities for these situations. With this being the case, Section B may not even be needed as long as the term accessible was included in the main sentence of number 9. Regarding 9C, we would ask why this part is even necessary. We acknowledge that this is in the current ED Rule 306.18A7 and understand that it's being moved from there to this section. However, New Hampshire is competency-based, and a submission and assessment of work is part of the grading system expectation. In addition, ED rules already dictate requirements for assessment of student learning as outlined in 306.24. We feel that this section is really not necessary and is duplicative. We would also ask if the State Board of Education believes that this flexibility creates an unfunded state mandate as the district, quote, shall, end quote, include accessibility by and inclusion for both individual and school-wide uses. This is why it's critical to allow and make clear that local school districts can make the decision for when remote learning is necessary. The language as it is currently written opens the door for broad and unlimited requests for remote instruction, even when districts do not have the ability or capacity to implement both models with fidelity. Local school districts need to be able to determine the amount of flexibility that they can offer. Otherwise, we strongly believe that this is an unfunded mandate. When a student with special needs requests remote instruction and requires one-to-one or in-home support, what are the liability and other fiscal issues presented with either, one, providing the support in the home, or two, denying the request because staff are not comfortable working in a home environment due to potential liability? Are we unnecessarily setting up an adversarial relationship between parents and the school district? What are the increased risks and how are those mitigated? Before these rules are amended, we request that the State Board of Education consider the liability implications and provide evidence-based practice guidance to districts. Commissioner Edelblue has insisted that these amendments are designed to grant more flexibility to districts, and we thank him for that opportunity. With that in mind, any amended language needs to reflect the allowability for each district to determine what flexibility they can reasonably and practically offer in consideration of student needs, family ability, and teacher capacity. I thank you for your time today and hope that you'll reach out to me if you have any questions. I can be reached by email or by phone at any time. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Carl. I just have this is Drew Klein. I have a quick question, and I appreciate you giving us these thoughts. I mean, this is why we're having this hearing. The rules are just a draft, and we realize that they probably need to be worked on as we go forward. Have you seen the School Administrators Association's proposed changes? I don't know if you guys have talked to each other about it. They had proposed changes too, but they're very different than yours. I just wondered if you'd seen them.
Well, the ones that I'm presenting are the School Administrators Association. I'm not sure what the other...
I'm sorry, School Boards Association is the other.
No. Contrary to popular opinion, Barrett and I don't coordinate on all these things.
Oh, I didn't know if you were coordinating. I just didn't know if you guys had talked about it
at
all.
No. Basically, okay. What we're looking for is flexibility in allowing school districts to be able to determine on a case-by-case basis when this flexibility should be implemented.
Okay.
You know, I'm not sure. I have not seen what the School Boards Association has proposed.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
So Bonnie Dunham is next on my list. Bonnie, are you on the line?
Drew?
Yep.
This is Helen. I had raised my hand for a question.
Oh. Okay, Helen, go ahead. I can't see that, unfortunately. So.
I know. I don't
Thank
know
you.
What our...
My apologies.
Okay. All right. I know I've been admonished not to do it more than once, and I get it. okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Carl, are you still on the line? That's my concern.
Yes, I am.
Oh, you are? Okay, great. Thank you. Carl, I had a question about the when necessary. I will confess that when we saw a draft of the initial proposed rules, I had many of the same concerns that you have about the ability of a school district to be mandated to have two delivery models of education. Certainly the flexibility is enormously important during the pandemic. I think these rules clearly will survive that. And I had pushed for the insertion of a word like, I don't know if that was my favorite word, but a word like when necessary to try and differentiate having there essentially being an a la carte system where folks could choose which delivery system they'd want at all times without a district being able to address that. So does that word, when necessary, create more problems, or is your comment suggesting that it needs to be clear is the school district ultimately making the decision about when necessary? I'm just trying to figure that out.
Thanks for the question, Helen. It does raise, I think, more concerns when it says when necessary, because it begs the question, when necessary determined by whom? And if it's necessary determined by the local school district, then I think that should be stated very clearly. But if it's the intent of the school, of the state board, to have when necessary determined by the parent as well as determined by the school board, then that does raise significant questions, which sort of ties into the rest of my testimony.
And Carl, are you submitting what you presented to us in writing also, a copy?
Yes, it's already been submitted to Angela.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was sent out as soon as it was in. So you should have that on email.
I didn't receive it, but I'm still looking.
It's not in the packet. It came later in a separate email.
I don't remember seeing it, and I asked Angela if the comments we got yesterday from the School Boards Association were the only ones. And she responded, but I don't think it was with that. I mean, there's been a lot of emails. I get it. Angela, did we get that? I will certainly go.
Yeah, this is Angela, and Carl submitted it, I think, this morning. So I have to go back and see what I included.
Okay.
But I do have it, and I will happily share it with the board.
Thank you.
This is Ann Lane. We actually received it as an email from Angela as public comment and public testimony yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah, we got that. It was in a packet of other ones. It's at the end of that list. Anyway, it's there, and if you need it again, we can send it. All right. Well, thank you, Carl. Bonnie, are you here? Is Bonnie Dunham on the line?
Let me unmute her. Real quick, right before we go to Bonnie, I just want to confirm I have a speaker with the phone number 603-673-0520. If you can just give me your name so I'm aware of who you are.
It's Kimberly LaValle with Spark.
Oh, great.
Perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Let me unmute Bonnie now.
All right.
She is unmuted.
Hi, Bonnie. You are up.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
My name is Bonnie Dunham, and I live in Merrimack, New Hampshire, and I'm providing this input as a parent of a young man who benefited from special education and wanting to make sure that the same opportunities that he had continue to be available to all other children with disabilities. So, first of all, I appreciate the recognition by both the governor in all of his emergency orders and by the New Hampshire Department of Education that they recognize the unique needs of students with disabilities and their emphasis on the requirement to continue providing a FAPE even when a school district is using remote instruction as its primary option for serving students. I also want to recognize the impressive efforts of most school districts in trying to meet the needs of all of their students during this emergency situation. That being said, I believe that given the wide variations in creativity and effort put in by different school districts throughout the state in meeting the needs of children with disabilities, very strong and clear language is needed, not things like should be provided. That's just not clear enough. It's in that context that I'm offering these proposed recommendations for changes. In ED 306-18A-7, where it says instruction may be offered remotely, I think it's important to add when a school has been closed due to inclement weather or other emergency, including a health emergency, so that it's not just that it's remote instruction is an option willy-nilly any old time. I think it needs to be pretty clear that it's when schools are closed for reasons based on emergencies. And then in the second part, in ED 306.14A9, where it has remote instruction for all students when necessary, I don't know if the when necessary question could be answered by just referencing ED 306-18A7 above, because that is where you talk about when it's necessary. But then where after C, I think that it's important that the remote instruction also that the district or the school board in a district develop a policy specifying that when a school is utilizing a remote instruction model due to a health emergency, so this isn't addressing a one-day blizzard, for example. So when a policy specifying that when a school is utilizing a remote instruction model due to a health emergency, procedures shall be implemented to ensure the provision of a free, appropriate public education for all students with disabilities, including by providing in-person instruction and related services if necessitated by the student's individual needs and consistent with the health and safety needs of the child, the child's teacher, and the child's parents. I agree that flexibility is important. Flexibility is all well and good, but in terms of providing a FAPE, failure is not an option. Regardless of where a child lives, that child has a right to receive instruction, including special education and related services, in a way that allows the child to both access and benefit from that instruction. The question shouldn't be, can we meet that student's needs, but rather, how can we meet a student's needs? And I'd be happy to participate in discussions, brainstorming efforts to try to broaden the way that school districts have identified the practices to meet the needs of children during difficult situations like this. But you can't leave the door open to leaving some kids out, and that has been happening. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie.
You're welcome.
Any questions?
Ann Lane has her hand raised.
Go ahead.
Hi, Bonnie, Ann Lane here. I would appreciate it, and I imagine my other board members would. Is it possible for you to deliver to us a printed version of what you just stated?
I can. I just finished writing it, and so that's why you didn't get it before. But, yes, I definitely will. I'll forward it to – should I forward it to Angela?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I will do that in just the next few minutes.
Great. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay. The next person on my list is Megan Tuttle. Megan, are you on the line?
I am.
All right. You are up. Go ahead.
Thank you. Megan Tuttle, president for NEA New Hampshire. And I'm not going to, I did submit written testimony this morning, and so I won't read the whole testimony right now, as you can read it. And I do agree with, you know, everything that that Dr. Ladd presented earlier. I just wanted to bring up one additional point. This is, you know, unprecedented times for us going through remote instruction. And I think this year, you know, is going to be a really interesting year to see how it all works out. We haven't had something like this in any of our lifetimes that I know about. But I think we really need to be spending this year making sure we can really assess whether we're able to maintain the rigor for remote instruction that this amendment would call for. And if we can't, what changes do we need to make at the district or state level to make sure that we can. You know, what kinds of assessments do we need to accomplish? What additional resources would our educators, school districts, families need to implement such a rule change and then to be able to maintain this over the life of this? This would be a pretty significant change, we feel, in the state rules. And so we just think we should be looking at this for the next year and really assessing it before we implement any changes at this point that, you know, might have some unintended consequences that we don't know what they are. So I'll leave it at that. I did submit the written testimony, so you can read that as well.
All right. Thanks, Megan. And if I can just comment, we've had similar thoughts here just about so this process started writing this rule before the governor came forward with his emergency rule for remote instruction for the year. So this public hearing is just part of that process moving forward. But we recognize that there's a lot of work that probably needs to be done on these rules and gathering information about how things are working this fall would be probably very helpful to us. And I appreciate your point about assessment and making sure the rigor is there. We are aware of that. That's one reason we put in on 9C, assessment of all student work completed during remote instruction, was to try to have some metric there for seeing how rigorous it is. So so we hear you, and that's definitely a concern we share as well. So thanks for your comments.
Yeah, thank you. You know, and the other thing, too, it's beyond the fall, though, I think we should be looking at this all year just because, you know, what is this going to do for kids that may be remote all year? You know, just looking at those types of things, and how does it affect the educators as well? So I know it's been a work in progress. It's going to take a little while. We're just, you know, recommending taking kind of a step back and really getting everything we need before we go ahead and actually, you know, make a change.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. Gotcha. Thanks. All right. Is there anybody else who I didn't have on my list who has called in to talk in this public hearing about remote instruction rules? Danielle, do you see anybody else on there that isn't one of the other parties that we have for later in the meeting?
As far as I'm seeing, I don't believe there was anybody else for a public hearing.
Okay. Well, the public hearing is open for 7 more minutes. So if anyone calls in, if you could just keep an eye on that and ask them if they're here for the public hearing, we'll keep it open.
Absolutely.
And we're going to move to the next item on the agenda, which is English language proficiency standards and assessment. Do we have Melissa here?
Yes.
Melissa White, or okay. And is Wendy Perrin here as well?
Yes, I am.
Great. All right, so I'm going to hand it over to you two, and I think we've all read the report. It was very long. but if you could just tee this up and explain to us very quickly what the issue is and why it's on the agenda for today.
Absolutely. So part of the requirement, one of the federal requirements that we have to abide by is having English language proficiency standards for our English language learning students. And so we are bringing before the board today the updated 2020 WEDA English language learning standards that we would like for you to look at and adopt. I'm going to turn things over to Wendy Perrin. Wendy is our English language learning education consultant. She can give a brief background on the standards, and then we can open it up for questions. Wendy?
Great.
Sure. Good morning. As Melissa said, federal law requires every state to formally adopt English language proficiency standards and assessments. This was first established in 2002 when the Elementary and Secondary Act of 1965 was authorized. And to meet the requirements, the New Hampshire State Board of Education met in 2004, and with the recommendation of a group of New Hampshire EL teachers, voted to adopt the WEDA ELP standards and assessments. And WEDA stands for World Class Instructional Design and Assessment. It is a member-based organization made up of 40 states dedicated to the research, design, and implementation of high-quality standards-based systems for K-12 English language learners. I've included a visual map of the other member states in your packet today. In 2004, when New Hampshire joined, WIDA was a 10-state consortium, and since then, membership has continued to increase, and I think this is a testament to the high-quality system WIDA has created and continues to develop, and to New Hampshire's wisdom as an early adopter. Since the original adoption, the standards and assessments have changed a couple of times, and federal law also requires the state educational agencies to attain approval from the State Board of Education anytime changes are made to those approved standards or assessments. And also, as part of a recent DOE peer review process, we discovered that the New Hampshire State Board of Education has not reviewed the state-approved standards and assessments since its initial adoption in 2004. So to prepare for today's request and our recommendation for you today, we have engaged the public, key stakeholders, and New Hampshire educators in a number of ways to gather input. The proposed adoption of the newest 2020 WIDA standards was discussed in May at a statewide EL educators meeting. The state EL advisory committee took up the issue at its July meeting. The statewide EL advisory committee membership includes representatives from institutions of higher education, New Hampshire DOE staff, members of our Title III consortia, EL educators, and educators on behalf of students with disabilities. Committee membership also includes a range of school districts representing the geographic diversity of the state. And we have just closed a two-week period of public comment, which was posted on the DOE website. And a notice of the public comment period was also emailed directly to all state superintendents, the statewide list of EL educators, and also posted on the professional listserv for EL educators, which is maintained through Southern New Hampshire University. So far, we have only received support for the state's continued adoption of the WIDA standards and assessments. And by approving this action today, it will allow us here at the DOE to offer training on the revised standards and to begin launching implementation in late spring and summer of the coming school year. And in addition, the department will remain compliant with federal laws and will file an update required by the peer review process with the U.S. Department of Education in December. And it will also allow New Hampshire to remain a member of the WIDA consortium, which includes technical assistance, access to a suite of professional learning opportunities for New Hampshire educators, as well as access to a support network of 39 other state agencies across the country.
All right. Any questions from the board?
Yes, I do. This is Sally Griffin.
Hi, Sally. Go ahead.
Yes, Wendy, can you just, it's been 16 years since it's been reviewed, and I just wanted to know, what's the next review period, or what is a review period?
So I think the steps from here, with the revision of the standards, I think the plan within the consortium is in 2025, they will then begin revision of the assessments that are aligned to those standards. So there seems to be a cycle of looking at the assessments, and then the revisions that have happened over the last 12 years have really been reflective of the changes with Common Core standards to make sure there's alignment there and to make sure the standards also met the rigor of the college and career readiness standards. So I don't expect any updates again until 2025.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Oh. Helen has a question. Go ahead, Helen.
Thanks. Wendy, is there a professional association for ESOL teachers, educators in our state? Is there a professional group?
We have what Northern New England ESOL teacher organization.
Okay, and was the request for comments on this sent to that group?
A member of that group sits on our statewide EL advisory board.
Mm-hmm.
And because this is Melissa White, because the Northern New England represents several states, not all of the New England states are using WIDA or the access test. For example, Massachusetts actually has their own that they've developed, I believe, and Wendy, you can correct me on that. So it wouldn't necessarily apply to that, a New England group because all of the states kind of choose their own assessment.
Okay, yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how ESOL educators in our state would have gotten some outreach on this. You know, that makes sense if it's a larger group, just our state, trying to figure out how they would have been provided with this for a review.
Yes, we had our meeting in May with the statewide EL educators that we had over 100 EL educators from around the state present, and this the standards were also emailed to every single EL teacher in our state so that they had time, and this was done early so they had time to review it and submit.
Okay, great.
Any
thank
comments?
Great, thank you.
Okay. If there's no other comment or question, I think we can entertain a motion.
Ms. Cindy?
I see that Ann has her hand raised.
Ann,
go ahead.
This is Ann Lane. I would just like some clarification on these standards and their alignment with our competency-based system and or Common Core. Is there alignment? Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. This is Melissa. Absolutely. One of the reasons why we really chose to continue with WIDA is because of the rigorous work that they have done to ensure that the English language standards that they have developed are aligned with the Common Core standards, and our competencies in our state are based on Common Core. And the nice part about that is that when we submit for a peer review to US Ed, all of these systems align, and that helps to ensure that we are appropriately serving all of our students and that everyone has equal access to the type of standards and level of rigor.
All right. Anybody else?
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have a motion? Anyone?
Sure, Drew. I would like to make a motion. You ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
I move with the recommendation of the Statewide EL Advisory Committee, the Statewide EL Educators Network, and input from the public that the State Board of Education adopt the WIDA 2020 ELP standards and the aligned assessments, number one, Access 2.0 annual ELP assessment, two, K-12 online screener initial assessment, and the alternate access for ELS with most significant cognitive disabilities.
I'll second that.
All right, roll call.
All right, just for the record, the motion was made by Ann Lane and seconded by Sally Griffin.
Yes.
Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagnon?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Thank you. Okay. Thanks, everybody. I'm going to close the public hearing. Danielle, we had nobody else call in?
I didn't see anybody else.
Okay. Public hearing on remote instruction rules is closed. And we are up to Shireen with the non-public school approval report.
Yes, good morning. How is everyone?
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Representing the Office of Non-Public Schools, we have two schools that are seeking an approval from the State Board of Education. One seeks to add new grade levels, and that is Acton Academy, New Hampshire. The other one is a new school called Our Lady of Mercy Academy, which seeks initial attendance approval status. It's a 9 through 12 school attached to an existing K through 8 school, St. Joseph's Regional School of Kane. Representing the schools here today are Anthony Toscano, Operations Manager, Christopher Smith, Principal, and I believe David Thibault, Superintendent of Catholic School.
Okay, so do you want to have the first one go?
Yep. Mr. Toscano or Mr. Smith, would you like to proceed?
Yes. So we are seeking to add grades 9 and 10 to our currently established school, and we are requesting approval from the state board to continue matriculating our students in through 9th and 10th. We are starting with roughly, I believe it's 17 students in that school. Shireen and Nate have been extremely helpful to us. There was a little bit of an issue with an occupancy permit because of a fire panel that was back ordered. It's now set and ready to be installed very, very soon, and we're extremely excited to get going.
And can you just clarify for the record which school this is? I'm not sure everybody caught that.
Not a problem. This is Our Lady of Mercy Academy, the extension of St. Joseph Regional School in Keene.
Right. And you guys were the ones up last month, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So remember, I don't know if everybody on the board remembers, they were up last month, and everything was checked off. Everything was good. They were just waiting for that last inspection report from the town, which had been delayed repeatedly. So that's the reason they were bumped to this month's meeting.
Yep, I remember it, Drew.
Okay, just making sure. Any questions? Any motion?
Sure. I move that the State Board accept and approve the following school for initial attendance approval status for the period of September 10th, 2020 through June 30th, 2023, Our Lady of Mercy Academy.
Cindy, I second that.
This is Helen. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Thanks. In the motion that was, I think, just said, there is, it doesn't say attendance purposes only, and that is the language we had been using consistently to make sure we weren't, that there wasn't any confusion created for the public. I'm just asking that, if you would, Anne, that the only be added and that always be part of our motion. We had talked about that, and maybe, Shireen, it was before your time, could have been. And I know that's the intent, but we were trying to use consistent language to make sure that it said attendance purposes only, and if Anne would accept that as an addition to her motion or a modification to her motion, I'd appreciate it.
Anne Lane, so moved.
Cindy Shagnon, second. I approve.
Roll call. Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagnon?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Our Lady of Mercy, and congrats.
Thank you very much. Thank you for all your help on this. We appreciate that.
Sure. I believe Acton Academy is up next. Would that be right?
Yes, Acton Academy is not here to represent themselves. I'm here to represent them in adding the two new grades, grade levels 7 and 8. This is Shereen.
Okay. Do we have any questions about that from anybody? All right, how about a motion?
Ann Lane, I move that the State Board accept and approve the following school to provide additional grade levels for the period of September 10th, 2020 through June 30th, 2023, Acton Academy of New Hampshire, and that this approval is for attendance purposes only.
Cindy Shag, and I second that.
Hey, roll call.
Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagman?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you.
All right. I believe we're good there, right? That was all we had?
That was all we had.
Okay. Thank you very much. So we're up to charter school updates. I'm going to bump ahead here and do Spark Academy first. Is Dennis on the line from Spark?
Dennis is on the line. I'm going to unmute him.
Good morning. My name is Ron Lozier, and Dennis just stepped up for 1 second. He'll be right back. But I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm not quite sure in terms of an update what you exactly are looking for from us, but I can... you know, we are in our second year. Yesterday was our first day. We're doing a hybrid model of instruction. Our incoming first year class is meeting on Mondays and Thursdays. Our second year students meeting with us on Tuesdays and Fridays, and Wednesdays is an entirely remote day for all students. We're operating on a four-block schedule, and our students take in a 90-minute period. Our students take humanities, math, science, and technology classes. We are housed at the Manchester Community College, right here at the college, so our students are actually using Manchester Community College resources for their technology classes. We have an entire third floor wing of classrooms where our humanities classes are taught in addition to science and math. Our math program is actually unique. It is an ALEX math program. It's an artificially intelligent design program, and students work independently in the ALEX program. They work at their own pace. We begin in the first year with an assessment of Algebra 1 skills, and based on demonstrated proficiencies, students will then advance to geometry, algebra 2, trigonometry, depending again on their skill levels. We teach a traditional science class beginning with physical science in semester 1, biology in semester 2. In the second year, students will be taking chemistry in semester 1 and physics in semester 2. Our humanities program is designed around a combination of English and world history, New Hampshire history and civics. It is taught on a basis of time periods, beginning with prehistoric times and watching the evolution of society through literature and through history over the, you know, up to 1776. Our technology classes are designed for students to receive certification in an area of technology called mechatronics. Based on that, they are involved in robotics in their first year and computer-assisted design using laser printers in that first year. In the second year, they're in manufacturing processes and electronic fundamentals. In the third year, they are looking at courses such as blueprint reading. And in their fourth year, their culmination year, they are then looking at robotics processes and getting certifications in those areas. We also have two certifications through the college available to our students in cybersecurity. We have a hardware and software certifications that students can pursue if that becomes their area of interest. They also can pursue certifications in networking and cybersecurity. So, actually, we are on. Mr. Mayu just stepped in, so I will let him pick up from where I left off. I was just giving them an overview of the program, Dennis.
Oh, okay. Well, continue.
Hi, Drew. Excuse me. This is Jane Waterhouse. I'd just like to give a brief introduction, if possible.
I'm sorry, Jane. Hi, Jane. This is Dennis. How are you?
Are you going?
Hello?
We can hear you.
Okay, so I'm sorry I missed that. Is our introduction completed, or would you like to hear more?
I think Jane was going to do something.
Okay.
So, Jane, are you ready to introduce? I mean, do your part?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, great. On July 23rd of this year, a first-year program audit was conducted via a Zoom conference call for Spark Academy of Advanced Technologies. Present at the Zoom meeting were four members of the school's Board of Trustees, two administrators, three teachers, and a number of students and parents. The purpose of a first-year program audit is to ensure charter schools are meeting the statutory requirements as well as meeting the unique and diverse needs of the students. The first year of the charter school's operation is critical in ensuring the future success of the school, and the department has a rigorous process for oversight and support. It's important to understand that this first year, the first year of a charter school's operation is a formative year where the plans the school developers envisioned and created are put into action. Spark Academy is committed to implementing a high-quality educational program that's aligned with its mission and vision, and they've demonstrated in their first year that significant progress has been made towards meeting the mission and goals of the school. The questions that that were asked at the audit were all focused on the school's governance and leadership, school operations, the education plan, fiscal management, and sustainability. In most areas of the program review, Spark Academy is meeting expectations for a first-year charter school. They demonstrate a thorough approach and understanding of their requirements. There were a few areas where the school is still in the process of development. which were listed on the rubric that you received, and there were no areas that were identified for needing significant improvement or attention. The department is pleased with the progress that Spark Academy has made in their first year, and that is reflected in the rubric and the comments that was sent to the board. So if you do have any questions about any of the information in the rubric, Dennis is here to answer your questions, and he has a team with him to assist him if he needs it. So I'll just pass it over to you for any questions you might have. Thank you.
Ann Lane has her hand raised. Go ahead, Ann.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
I can hear you, yes.
Welcome, and it's a pleasure to meet with you. I wish it was in person. I was very impressed. I went to your website, and I read the letter that you sent out to your school community. Your timeliness, your comprehensive, your efforts. I have a couple questions. My impression is that your enrollment is slightly lower than expected. So what are your new alternative recruitment plans? And my second question is, are you finding that your 15-to-1 ratio is effective? Thank
you. Well, I'll answer that in reverse a bit. The 15-to-1 ratio was by design. Our cohorts are small. That's actually the cap on the size of our cohorts. And that was initially driven by the needs for the technology coursework that the students would be involved in, where the per pupil presence in the classroom is even more stringent than would be the case in a typical high school lab classroom. We have more to do in terms of enrollment. There is no doubt that the lockdown with the pandemic affected us, because the ability to conduct on-site open house events was very productive for us in the spring and the summer, and we had conducted one in-person open house, and a follow-up to that is for us to have one-on-one meetings with families as they apply to the school. We had begun that last year. It's a practice that I've undertaken frequently in my life prior to Spark. And that was progressing well. We felt we were on the money, and then the lockdown occurred, and a lot of loss of focus, it seemed, in terms of looking beyond the immediate needs with respect to education and thinking beyond that. We conducted a number of virtual open houses. I've been involved and run open houses for about 30 years, and I've been impressed with what this team has been able to do virtually. The outreach has been somewhat limited. That is, the yield in terms of attendees at those virtual open houses. It's my suspicion that because about 50% of our student body comes from a homeschooling experience, that many of the families that we're looking at us have decided to stay with what is known to them, and that is the homeschool model. Many of our with our virtual open houses, we had a growing number this summer of families looking ahead to the year beyond this one that we have just begun. So we're continuing to give the pun spark interest in that year beyond this one. I don't think there's anything systemic that we've done poorly. In fact, our families have remarked frequently that it was a leap of faith for them to send their kids to Spark for 2019 and 20, because it really, you know, hadn't taken off yet, and they were buying into the vision that we were providing. And they said, we delivered. And it's a lot of program. There are a lot of moving parts. We have in this year melded very well with Manchester Community College. We have we've established a very sound relationship with the college, and you know, we are working at moving ahead in terms of the effectiveness of getting that message out. I think it's a lot of program and a very different program for families to understand if they're comparing it to a conventional program. You know, the enrollment is something that you know, we embrace. We're making that work well for us this year with some additional financial support. But we are also, and that support is from a donor, the generosity of a donor who believes very much in the program, and his foundation does. But we've got three cohorts functioning very well. Two in that second year. One right now in that first year. We've got a great program in place. We've expanded, documented the program for 4 years, adding, as I think Mr. Lozier has said before, computer information systems to the advanced manufacturing program that was part of the Spark curriculum from the beginning. So systemically, I think we've got everything in place. I think we need that delivery system that can, you know, compete with all the static that is out there, or the distraction, the anxiety in terms of what schools look like and what's going on in general with concerns over COVID. We're doing it. To the board's credit, you know, they have freed up my schedule so that I'm no longer teaching classes this year. Last year, I was teaching two-thirds of a full-time schedule. And this year, they've invested in my having the time to get out more and focus on both enrollment and fundraising further. So I applaud the board, and I'm grateful to the board for having done that. We still have some challenges in terms of getting physically out to organizations like the Boys and Girls Club and YMCA and so forth. But I'll be getting out to area businesses and industry and really beginning to help spread the word relative to, you know, Spark's, the opportunities that Spark affords its students. Long with an answer, I'll apologize for that.
Thank you very much. I have two other concerns, and they are both pretty much out of your control. One is whether the circumstances require Manchester to close school for any limited amount of time. And the second is your Manchester transportation, being public transportation. If you could speak to both those things, what
yes.
your terms of plans would be close
you
their doors
up.
Temporarily, and
were,
also your, can you still hear me?
You were breaking up a little bit, but I think I've got the gist of both questions. One is Manchester, the MTA, Manchester Transit Authority, and our ability to move to a remote model. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Well, first of all, answering in reverse once again, we can't say enough with respect to the Manchester School District and MTA for bending over backwards. They've done that for us last year, providing a superb and thoughtful service to our students. They're doing that this year, although the Manchester Public Schools are not in person at this point. They are providing transportation to our students through hubs. Now, today was our first in-person day, and transportation went about the way you would think it would in the first week of school. And I just said to our staff earlier, and I've said it over and over again, God bless those people for trying to sort out all the moving parts for that. But Manchester transportation has been great. The school district's been great, and I think we're going to be fine in that respect. So in terms of going remote, we decided 2 months ago that we would prepare
for a hybrid model so that the students, the teachers, could really begin a solid preparation and do so without losing their minds in the process. So we are set up to embrace both remote learning and in-person learning to the extent we can and with whatever circumstances come our way. So each class is available through live streaming, and one thing we learned in the spring is that we wanted to go with synchronous classes. So our classes all meet at regular times. Yeah, we had a couple of bucks today. It's our first in-person day, but that all sorts out. But the our plan, as we're implementing it now, is that each class is synchronously live streamed for those students who wish to remain remote all the time. Our in-person experience is done with 6 feet of spacing. Fortunately, we've got plenty of space here to the college to work with. We did need to purchase 15 additional laptops for our students so that every student has a dedicated laptop and we're not touching surfaces we don't need to. They're at their desks throughout the day, remaining in the same classroom for the day. The teachers circulate. Everyone's masked up. All the staff has been COVID tested recently. And then, you know, I've asked the teachers to prepare pieces that will be posted online, which are the kernels for both the live streamed and in-person instruction, so that the students have a structure to go to in order to review for whatever performance assessment is going to take place, be it projects or other vehicles. We were fortunate right from the get-go in the spring in that our program is steeped in technology. So the students take, as you might imagine, technology classes. They take CAD and in their first year and robotics as well. And we were in the middle of robotics in the spring. If they needed laptops, we could lend them to them. Each student received a robotics kit, and those kits weren't cheap, $500 a piece, and they took good care of them. Our math program is online. It's an AI-based program. The math coach, that math coach was able to work with them via Zoom. Science had and has plenty of online resources this year. We're going to be using Labster as well. So we were able to hit the ground running last year. The one missing part is that we didn't go synchronous, and we felt that that left our students at a disadvantage. So this year it's all hybrid all the time. Our cohorts alternate days. Our second-year students, first-year students will be in on Mondays and Thursdays. Second-year students will be in on Tuesdays and Fridays. Wednesdays are always a creative day, exploration days. Before the COVID lockdown, we were doing that in person with a lot of field trips and various learning experiences outside the building. But the lockdown, we've had to go virtual, and we're doing a lot of things with the students in that respect, and did so in the spring as well. Certainly hope to get into the physical and on-site experiences with the students, but we're ready to go either way. We're doing it at this point. So whatever happens with Manchester, we're ready for that. And in terms of an all-remote model, we think we've got the best of all possible worlds.
Thank you very much.
Hope that wasn't too long.
No, it's all very appreciated.
Hi there. This is Cindy. I had my hand up. I don't know if it came through or not. Okay. Can I ask
you
a question? All righty.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I found everything very fascinating. I have a few questions. Number one, did I hear correctly, though, that in the humanities program with the English and the, you know, everything amalgamated together, that you stopped in 1776? There's a lot that's happened in the world since then.
Oh, no. So that's
So in our first year, we're going from ancient history to the end of the Middle Ages. In the second year, it's the Renaissance of 1776. After that, in the third year, it's 1776 to modern times. The students move into will be moving into a U.S. history course in their fourth year, and that course is part of the Manchester Community College curriculum. And at the same time, they'll be taking their English Comp 1 or 101 at that point as well. So our goal is to start moving our students into actual Manchester Community College courses in their third year, and we're projecting that each student will be taking 2 out of 4 of their courses within the college curriculum. And in the fourth year, our goal is to have them taking all of their courses in the college if possible, if they can make that work, if it works for them individually.
Thank you. My other question, and this is just a thought that came to my mind while you were speaking today, I wondered in the future and long-term goals, if you ever wanted to move to more of a, like a VLAC thing where students or, you know, there's so many high schools around Manchester that, you know, and in Manchester that might send their students to the Manchester School of Technology. However, their facilities are, to a certain extent, limited with tremendous options that you offer in all these very intense, higher-level robotics, cybersecurity, all of these types of issues for the pre-engineering students and all these students that might want to remain in their high school for, you know, like the community college does, for the certain amount of their general curriculum, but then come to you for these advanced courses that I don't know if the Manchester School of Technology would ever be able to offer, but, you know, the tremendous computer work and all this type of thing. Has there been any thought to ever having a dual program, a dual enrollment, where you have your full-time students and then you also have students for your very advanced engineering and scientific programs?
Well, it's very interesting that you should pose that question. Now, this is something that's in a very nascent phase, and it's not something I brought up for conversation with our board. But in the course of our preparations for this hybrid model, especially as we really got down to nuts and bolts in August, we began to think, those of us here, you know, on the team within the school, that, and I posed the question, does all of this ask us to be better somehow? And this experience is likely to leave, if not a permanent, very long-lasting stamp on education. So is this asking us to do something differently, do something better, offer more opportunities? And again, just very loose banter right now within the school here on the staff. What if it were to continue, or at least parts of it, as a hybrid model? So what if, you know, take a look at the humanities program, whatever parts of the program we think could really work well in a totally remote or largely remote model. So maybe it's a matter of students going nearly all remote with, you know, a physical experience periodically every 2 weeks, once a month. You know, there are schools, in my experience, I've met up with people who run schools that are very largely virtual and have been for years, and they offer these communal events to provide that experience as well. So it's interesting you ask the question, because we're asking the same question here. We are far from arriving at an answer, but I think this is all asking us to think differently and perhaps to improve what, you know, what we've been doing.
I think I'm talking more about, instead of being, you know, hybrid as far as being online, I'm saying taking, you know, like with Manchester School of Technology, where they take a lot of their core courses at their high school, but then all these advanced technology, engineering, science courses that you may have the facilities to offer that neither Manchester School of Technology or a high school could offer, the student who's going to the Worcester Polytech or Rensselaer or some of these, you know, MIT could come and take those experiences with you. And I think this would be such an exciting option for your school and for the others, but I don't know if you've gone to this level of thinking.
No, we have not yet, and you know, we are always open to improving what we're doing and looking at possibilities, I think any idea is worth at least considering. But no, we have not spoken along those lines. In fact, you know, we are very respectful of MST and have known that they run a very effective program, been doing so for some time. So, you know, we haven't thought a lot along those lines. We're willing to entertain ideas, but we've got massive respect for people at MST. I know a lot of people there individually, and they're doing fantastic work. So, I mean, if at some point, you know, they were to reach out to us, we would certainly listen.
Yeah, I don't mean to be saying anything negative about Manchester School of Technology. I know that they have a lot of population, and they are also trying to do their 4-year school and this type thing. I have grandchildren in Exeter, and I know the Seacoast School of Technology offers very intensive engineering classes from the 9th grade and pre-engineering in the last 2 years. So I think this is something that you could look at in cooperation with Manchester School of Technology as far as what they can offer and any additional things that you could offer that could really help the students in this catchment district. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much, Dennis. Yep,
Drew?
Kate? Yeah,
Kate,
go ahead.
Can I ask you a question? I did do the side thing, but it doesn't work. Great report, excellent for the first year. Very, very good. The only, Miss Jane, are you still there too? No? Okay.
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. On the employee job descriptions, make sure you have those completed. I know they're in process, but they should have been completed. Make sure you have one to give one to everybody who works there or volunteers. Make sure they get a copy in their file. Yeah. Make sure you do that. Keep an eye on your headcount. That's one thing you want to do. Make sure you get more into your community involvement, Lions Club, Rotary, Chamber of Commerce, all of that. The other thing, Jane?
Yes.
Jane, you right there?
Yes, I'm here.
Right. I didn't get a copy of the annual budget. All it says it was submitted.
I can send that to you.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Thank you.
That's great.
I'd like to have one submitted with the reports, if we could, Jane, on that.
Okay, from now on, I'll include the budget with the report.
Yep. And then after this, Drew, I had a question for Jane anyway.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh. Jane, I'm wondering if because these employee job descriptions aren't done yet, that we should require written job descriptions when they we receive their application. Just a thought. Make sure they're done.
You mean they're, for their original application? Yep, that's a good idea.
Yep, correct.
Okay.
Yeah, Kate, that's actually something we've been thinking about requiring, so it's a good idea.
It's the law.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dennis. The report's very strong. I think from all that we've heard, you guys are doing a really pretty impressive job down there. So,
thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
All right, take care.
You too.
And Jane?
Yes.
Yep. Great job for enforcing due dates, too. I think Jane knows what I'm talking about.
You should be seeing a little more soon.
Good job, because they were calling me, and I said, no way, I'm backing her up. Due date. Yeah, 5 years. Get it in.
Thank you.
Send me a copy of the budget, because I do track all of these, so if you can do that, that would be great.
Yes, I'll send it. Would you like, would all the board members like it? Should I send it to Angela just to forward to everyone or send it directly to you? Okay.
Oh, I want one. I don't know if anybody else wants one, but we should have
submitted
before.
Yeah, I think go ahead and send it to everybody. It would be good.
All right, I'll send Angela to forward to everyone.
Yep, that, I think that's important to be submitted with this one-year report, but I love the one-year report. Really good.
All right. I'll keep that. I'll add that to the list for the first year program.
Okay, so we have VLAC up.
Okay, so
do you want to give this up?
Yes, I'll give an introduction to this piece of business. The department received a letter on August 27th from the Virtual Learning Academy Charter School requesting an amendment to their charter to allow for an enrollment increase of 2,295 students spread across all grades from kindergarten through grade 12 in order to meet the needs of New Hampshire students and families during the COVID-19 pandemic. And I believe Steve Kosakowski is on the call now to answer any questions you have.
Drew?
Yeah.
If I'm reading this correctly, it jumps up. It goes from 2022 to a 4,307 headcount. Why is the drastic jump?
Well, because, I mean, I can let the school address that, but it's COVID. We have,
is that all it is? Is that it?
It's a massive increase in applications based primarily on either. Have they broken into two categories? But let me go ahead and hand that over to Steve if you're here.
Yeah. I'm not sure what his phone number is supposed to be. So if he is on there, I would like you to press 5 and then star. And then if I see that your hand is raised, I'll unmute you.
Is it 5-star or 5-pound we hit? Because maybe that's why I'm not getting through to speak.
I think it's 5-star. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep, it's 5-star.
It's 5-star, but I've had my hand up a few times and have not been recognized.
Danielle, it's possible the phone number is 778-2500.
Let me see. I'm not seeing that number on here.
Okay, that's the VLAC phone number.
So I have just texted Steve. This is Commissioner Edelblue, and I just texted him to see if he's able to get on. In the meantime, I can probably address this, and I do know that Caitlin, I believe, is on the call as well and has been working closely with VLAC around this increase, if that's okay with the board.
Sure.
While we're waiting for Steve.
Oh, yeah.
Angela,
yeah.
Do you have a quick question?
Yes. I just wanted to let you know the number I have for him, for Steve, is 603-418-4893. So if you just want to keep a lookout for that.
Yes, I will.
Great. And I do know that Steve had intended to be on this call, so I'm not sure what may have come up that has prevented him from being here. But really, this is an increase, a significant increase, and we recognize that it is a significant increase. It is driven, as Drew pointed out, really by two aspects, both of which really are driven by the COVID circumstances in the state. So on the one hand, we have a number of families who, because of the COVID circumstances on the ground, are concerned about allowing their children to go back into the in-person learning environment. And it's likely that that is because of some kind of an underlying health condition, either for the student or maybe a family member that they reside with or that they spend a frequent amount of time with. And so those families are seeking an alternative opportunity to access their education that limits their exposure to a larger number of people. And so those students are turning to and have turned to VLACs to get enrollment in those districts. And then as well, a number of our districts are in-person, and we'll talk about a little bit of that later, but a lot of other ones are offering hybrid programs or remote programs. And in some of those circumstances, again, where we have in-person instructions, families are not able to take advantage of that in-person instruction and so are continuing to be enrolled in the school, but the school itself offered VLACs to those families as a remote instruction option. One of the early schools that offered this to a number of students was over in Rochester. They've got 4,200 students, and they offered families VLACs as a remote instruction option. And I think we have, as many as 250 students from Rochester that continue to be enrolled in the Rochester school system but are accessing their education through VLACs. And so this increase is really to accommodate all of that flexibility in the system that allows our district schools to respond to the needs of their community and offer those families that are not otherwise able to access the educational opportunities that the district is offering, because of some type of a health reason, to be able to access VLACs.
May I ask a question, Commissioner? This is
of
Helen.
Course.
Hey, Helen, just to interrupt real quick, this is Caitlin. I just talked to Steve. He was going to call back in so to try to see if he could get unmuted. So. He will be
we can
here
maybe hold for a second because he can. It would be good for him to have his perspective.
So I'm waiting, right?
I think we're pausing for a moment to see if Steve
okay.
is calling in.
No problem.
And our call moderator is going to be looking for that incoming call and unmute that number.
What was the other number that I had been told? I know I have the 418-4893, but I know there was another number we were looking out for.
The other number that you'll be looking for is a 778-2500, or at least the 778 trunk.
Drew, can I ask a question with Commissioner?
Sure.
Well, I mean, Helen's in the queue, though, so I guess if we'll take questions.
Sorry.
Let me start with Helen, then, unless it's a specific question.
I'm happy to wait if we're trying to figure out getting Steve on. I'm good.
Okay.
However you want to do it, Chairman, if you want me to ask the question, if we're trying to wait to get Steve on so he can hear it all, whatever you want to do.
I mean, I think it'd be good to get Steve on because he can answer with more
okay.
clarity. But
okay.
if yeah.
I mean, we'll give him a couple more minutes, maybe, and I can try to merge a call with him if I can get him with my cell phone or something. I'll try to do something. I don't know
okay.
if he's just having technical issues with the sound.
Okay, so I just got a text from him, and he's on the line. Maybe it's yet another number. I'm going to see if I can't find out his number so you can unmute him.
All right. I do have a number up on here that just came in a minute ago. That's 585-5472.
Do you want to just unmute that one and see if they can identify themselves?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm texting now, yeah. Okay, the 585 number is Steve, so.
Perfect. I will unmute him. You are now unmuted.
Hi, everybody. This is Steve Kozakowski. Sorry for the mix-up.
No problem. Hi. Welcome.
So, Steve, I'll set the table. So, Steve, I talked a little bit about the increase in enrollment and explained that there's really a couple of drivers. One is just families who are choosing to go to VLACs for their education, kind of on their own and independently, but the bigger driver really is the district schools who are using VLACs as their remote instruction option for many students, and so they have come to you as well, and that's pretty much what I said. I don't know if you want to add some granularity to that, and then we have questions from Helen and from Kate.
Sure. I can just give you a few numbers. Since July 1st to September 7th, there have been 6,069 individual students that have come to us representing 18,805 half credit in enrollments. And just to give some scope to that, that's overall, looking at those half credit enrollments is about almost three times what we normally see in this period, this time frame from July 1st to early September. So it's been pretty significant. One of the questions that typically comes up is, are districts sending those students to you or are parents coming in? And that's a hard question to answer because all of our courses, all of the full-time enrollments are determined by parents. So a school may suggest or recommend, but no school can directly enroll a student with us. When a student does come to us, once a parent has approved it, we do ask them for their affiliation, what school district they're at, but there's a combination and it's hard to determine where the line is. Did someone hear from a counselor you should take Algebra 1, make the decision not to do it, take it into consideration, and then maybe later do it? Is that really the school sending them to us or just a choice being made? And there are certainly other times when parents just say, yes, I'd like you to take this course, period, without any consultation with local schools. So hopefully that gives you some context, and I certainly happy to fill in any details or answer any questions.
Can I go ahead, Drew?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, this is Helen, and I'm not sure who best is able to answer. I have two questions. Commissioner, when you talked about school districts are offering to their students as part of their remote option, to utilize VLACs. And then Steve said, the school district doesn't actually make that decision. Ultimately, the parent does. I'm wondering what's happening with the adequacy funding on that. That's a huge number. And if, how is that being calculated? If a school district is using that as their remote option, what's happening with the funding there? I think there had been, maybe a little bit of discussion about holding districts harmless, but I don't know what an ultimate decision was on that. Can you, Commissioner, are you the most appropriate person to address that?
Sure, I would be happy to do that. So we continue to follow the charter funding mechanism in law for VLACs. And so we have, even without a pandemic, we often have district schools that have students access VLACs programming. And when that happens, the districts continue to receive their programming, and then VLACs is paid for, and it's like a pay-for-success type of a model. They're paid for those students who successfully complete competencies across courses and earn the credits. So that remains in place, so there is no penalty at the district level for the districts that are sending those students to to VLACs as a remote instruction option. We are having ongoing conversations with the governor's office and believe that there'll be an announcement forthcoming in the, relatively quickly to engage some of the CARES Act funding to help supplement what is obviously a large increase in the numbers of students accessing that programming.
Okay, and so we just don't know the answer to that piece yet, but that may, CARES monies may be available for that?
That's right. We're having those ongoing conversations.
Okay. Drew,
but
could
to
I...
But to your point, the districts are not penalized through the existing law.
Okay. Drew, could I ask Steve a couple
yeah,
of questions?
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Steve, of this huge increase, do you have a sense of how many are out-of-state students? Because people can purchase service, right? I mean, they can choose to buy your services, right?
Yes. Typically, over the course of we usually see around 100 students. Right now, I think we're at 140, and we're not, doing anything to encourage additional people coming in. Matter of fact, one of the things we've discussed is as this goes on, we may just have to say for now, we need to take care of New Hampshire students. But at this point, it has not, we have not seen an overwhelming response because of the pandemic.
And how have you been able to increase your educator load to meet? I mean, this is just an astonishing number that if any school had to deal with it, I mean, you folks do an excellent job. What are you doing to get enough educators?
Yeah, since July 1st, we've hired 73 adjunct instructors. We always start with adjunct, and then as they've been with us for a period of time, then we consider moving them to full-time. So we've hired 73. As of this point, 62 are active, and 11 are still in training. We've hired two additional guidance counselors, one additional office support. We did move six of our adjuncts to full-time status. Right now, we're in the process of hiring an additional 30 instructors, promoting an additional four to full-time status, another guidance counselor, another customer service person to answer phones. One of the advantages we have, as you might guess, is that we tend to look in New Hampshire, and most of our staff are from New Hampshire, but then New England will be the next kind of region and then nationally. And so as it's been harder to find people, we have started to accept applications from almost anywhere. The caveat is they all have to be certified. We expect they've also been experienced in the classroom because we want to know the age group they're teaching. From a beyond the online side, and they all, once they are hired, then through the reciprocal agreement become certified in New Hampshire.
Okay, and how is this going to impact also the kindergarten program you were planning for? Do those increase?
Those are all
kindergarten.
Yes, that includes K through 12.
Okay, and what's the impact on this increase with and kindergarten programming?
Yeah, let me look through my numbers here. So I didn't break it down by grade level, but I have it broken down by level, elementary. So we have just looking at my notes. I want to get the right part here. So. These are enrollments. When we speak about enrollments, that's half credit. So obviously you don't really give out credits at the elementary level, but we need something to measure. So a half credit is about a half year. So we've had 6,500 enrollments at the elementary level. Let's see, 4,700 at the middle, 11,000 at the high school level. So the elementary grew very, very quickly. We had a two-week period where we were seeing numbers that were just astronomical. During our highest enrollment periods, which usually are the last week in August, the first week in September, we've never experienced more than 1,600 half-credit enrollments. Well, at the end of August, well before this period, we had 1 week where we had 7,000 and another week where we had 5,000. And that's where we had to enter into the wait lists and closing courses until we hire additional staff. And a lot of those were elementary level.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, any other questions?
I think Kate had a question.
Kate, go ahead. Kate, are you there?
Well, sorry. I'm right here. I just want to say, Steve, I went to your graduation and really back your program up here. You've got 2,000. Okay, are you maxed out right now, full-time students? Because we capped you at 2,022. You've got that many full-time? I know you're talking about half-time.
When you see a number like 2,022, that's full-time equivalent. So that includes all the part-time students as well. Right around 500 full-time students. We're still accepting applications, but we're telling families, because a lot of courses are full, that it just may take longer to get them activated, because if we don't have courses, we can't activate them. So our hope is that by early October, around first or second week in October, we can have most, if not all, of the wait list taken care of. But it's certainly been a big job, and I have to really give kudos to my staff, because they've been working night and day to try to accommodate everyone's needs.
What is how many do you have on your waiting list right now?
A lot. And I'll give you those. Just check out the numbers here. So if we look at just number of students on the waiting list, at the elementary level, we have 1,000. At middle school, over 400. At high school, 1,100. So that's kind of the breakout. But
1,100. All right. So you're up to, well, I'm just wondering if you're asking for enough seats. When you started out with your staff, how did you increase? How much staff members did you have before this all happened? What was your staff members?
230 total employees.
Right. And that includes your teachers, it includes everything, right? Your staff,
yes.
Your administrative?
Yes. Right.
Okay. So you've increased your headcount. What is your staff now? You said you went through all this hiring, you've hired this one, that one, you increased and trying to keep up. What's your staff count now?
Just over 300.
So you increased it 100?
73 plus some support staff, 73 instructors.
Okay. Just be careful. Don't be too big too quick and then bam, you know?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I think that brings up a good point. is what is the way out of this? Because we don't, obviously none of us expect this to happen. Stay forever. And so as we're hiring everyone we've hired since July 1st, we've been very clear with them that we don't know when the pandemic will recede, but when it does, obviously a lot of people we expect and we hope will go back to their traditional schools. And when that happens, we'll need to reduce our staff as well. So we've thought that through to make sure that, you know, there's no expectation that we hold on to staff for a year or more, because even when we don't have the students.
Okay. All right. So I'm just figuring out your headcount and stuff. Okay, I'm all set through. Are you sure you're giving yourself enough? 4317 is 2300, and you've got 2100, estimated 2100. Sure you're allowing yourself enough headcount room?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and
right?
You know, funds just aren't unlimited. I certainly understand that. So one of the things, as I've talked to the commissioner and to Caitlin, is I think it's fair to say that we're going to double. But you could almost, if you just open things up wide, you know, the sky's the limit. This could really get out of hand as far as availability of funding. So one of the things I'd like to do by kind of putting this this number forward is to say, let's live within this budget. And certainly, you know, if we get three quarters of the way through the year and the pandemic roars back and we need additional help, we would come back. But my hope is that this will work out.
Yeah, because you got 2,500 waiting list, but you're only requesting 2,295
difficult. Those are two different numbers. One is full-time equivalent. That's the 4,317. And when I give you numbers like we have 2,600 students, a lot of those students are taking one course. They're only part of a full-time equivalent. So
yep, I got that.
It's not quite as – okay.
Okay. I just want to make sure you're not going to come back a week later and say, oh, guess what, I need more need more.
It won't be a week. No.
Okay. God, I hope not. Oh. All right. Has your numbers on the full time, have they increased?
They certainly have increased, not as significant as this as the other numbers that I've shared with you, but we have a couple hundred waiting to be processed, and we're waiting for courses to open up. So.
Yeah, we're great folks. I was really impressed. Great program.
Thank you.
I'm all done. Thank you very much.
Cindy, did you have a question? I see your hand is raised.
Yes. Yes, thank you very much. Number one, I just think that VLAC does an amazing job, and it's just so marvelous for the students in New Hampshire to have access to it. My question, though, I was a little confused when you were talking about the funding issue. I think someone said that Rochester recommended VLAC for their, you know, remote students who want to go to high school. And then someone said, well, they're being held harmless. And if a student goes, you know, is enrolled in Rochester High School, but elects to be a full-time student at VLAC, and then so VLAC gets the funding for that student, the adequacy, but Rochester still keeps getting the adequacy, although the student is not enrolled in their remote program at all. Is this double dipping? I mean, is the state paying twice for the same student, or is that where this CARES money comes in and almost refunds Rochester for losing this student to VLAC? What's going on with the funding?
So Rochester would not lose any of its adequacy funding under the current law. Under the current law, even without a pandemic, if a student attends the district school and in that district, so that district is receiving full adequacy funding for that student. If that student, while in the district school, which is a normal thing that happens, accesses a VLAX class or classes, more than one, that district would continue to receive all of their adequacy for that student, and VLAX would receive funding for those classes. I was not part of the legislature when that type of law was put in place. My understanding is that the attempt was to make sure that we're affording students the opportunities to access a variety of curricular materials that VLAX offers that may not be offered in a district school. So there was no financial penalties to a student accessing curricular instruction through VLAX, even though that student is enrolled in a district school. So this is just that same concept, but at a larger scale, which is part of our conversation around, you know, with the governor's office around accessing CARES Act funding to help support this.
I certainly understand hold harmless, but it just seems like if the student, if we were in a regular session and a student was not physically for 1 minute in Rochester School in a regular in-person scenario, it just seems interesting that they still get the funding while the student is actually not there in any way, shape, or form. But like you said,
I'm not sure, Cindy, that anyone anticipated that you would have this type of movement at this scale.
Yeah, I don't think anybody could anticipate it this year, 2020. Thank you.
Could I just add one clarification, though? Even during the pandemic, if a student decides to withdraw from a school and come to us as an official full-time student, one that's on track to get a diploma for us, the funding then gets separated. The
correct,
school would
lose
direct
their enrollment.
Adequacy. Yes.
So what Steve is saying, if a student unenrolls from a district school, then obviously they're not enrolled in the district school.
Thank you. That answers a lot of questions.
Okay, anyone else? All right, I would entertain a motion.
This is Cindy. Pursuant to RSA 194B, colon 3, 11, or XI, I move that the State Board of Education authorizes Virtual Academy Learning Academy Charter School to amend the charter to increase enrollment from 2022 to 4,317 full-time equivalent students.
I'll second that. Sally Griffin.
Okay, roll call.
Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagman?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Steve, good luck. I know this is a complicated time for you, so I hope it all goes well.
Thank you all for your support. It's very much appreciated.
All right. At this point, we are approaching noon. I think it would be appropriate to take a brief break.
Thank you, Drew.
You're welcome. Okay, I'm going to gavel us into break for 5 minutes, so maybe you could all mute your phones, and we'll come back in five. All right, just checking in. Is everybody back, or do we have some stragglers?
Kate, I'm back.
Ann, I'm here.
Cindy, I'm here. Sally, I'm here.
So we're waiting on Helen. Helen, are you back?
I'm back.
All right.
I'm sorry. I've been sitting here. Sorry about that.
Okay. I think we're all here. So the next item we have is Professional Standards Board applications. This is exciting. Steve Appleby, are you here?
Yes, good morning. This is Steve Appleby, Division Director at the Department of Education.
Good morning. So, I don't think we really need a lot of explanation here. Everybody got these applications. They are for the positions that are opening up in the section that, for which they applied. Are there any questions of Steve about these applicants? Any concerns or thought by members?
Oh, this is Sally.
Hey,
I'm good. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Steve. I'm curious as to how many applicants, you know, from what applicant pool you chose, you know, these two came forth and came before us.
Yes. Good morning, Sally. Thank you for the question. These, in fact, are the only two applicants that we have at this time. For open positions. We have several more open positions and are soliciting other applicants, but these are the two at the time that have come forward, and the chair of the PSB, Cynthia Lucero, who couldn't be on this call, was in favor of moving these forward to the state board. So you're there.
Thank you.
Just based on resume, I thought these were two of the strongest applicants we've had in a while. Do we have a motion?
I agree with that.
Anybody want to make a motion?
Ann Lane, I'm happy to if Cindy doesn't.
That's fine. I'll let you. I'm not let you. I'll be happy for you to.
All righty. I move that the, because I don't believe we received anything giving us instructions, that we approve the applications for the Professional Standards Board, Christina White, and Christopher Benedetti.
Cindy Shagnon, I second that.
All in favor? Roll call.
Aye. Sally Griffin, yes. Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagnon?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Okay. Now we're up to the really fun part. We have our vocational rehab program rule changes. I hope everyone read every detail of this massive rule and digested it and understands it thoroughly. So I'm going to ask Amanda to just give us the background on this. There was a long back and forth process for how these rules came about and how we wound up with the final proposal that we have before us now. So are you on, Amanda? Oh, she was just here a second ago. Amanda, are you here? I think she may be eating lunch.
She is unmuted, and she is a speaker on
okay,
here.
All right. So Amanda's actually here physically. So she is in the room. And, you want to pull it? We're just going to try to get her a seat closer to this. Well, it's this part. She's got to speak into this. So I'm going to move this a little closer to Amanda so hopefully everybody can hear her. All right, ready?
Sorry about that. I couldn't mute my phone for some reason. I don't know what was going on. So the first rule that you have in front of you is the Voc Rehab Rules, which is a final proposal. I'm going to give a little brief description of the process that we've gone through with the Voc Rehab Rules. So as you might recall, these started out with the initial proposal striking out all of the language that was copied and pasted directly from the federal regulations. So the initial proposal was a very bare bones document. Then in between the initial proposal and the public hearing, we got an audit report that described some of the things that we needed to make sure we had incorporated in our rules. Forms and anything that's customer facing that affects people outside of the agency had to go into the rules. So the final proposal looked a lot different from the initial proposal. Then we had a second public hearing because of that. We had no public testimony. This is the final proposal with all of the language put back in that is customer facing and describes the process for how someone would apply for services through Voc Rehab and how eligibility is determined for Voc Rehab. This final proposal is due to OLS. Our deadline is tomorrow. So if there are any changes that you see that you want to be made, we should try and work that out now. But also, we have another part of the rulemaking process called conditional approval requests. So this final proposal would get submitted to OLS. They haven't even given me any comments on the initial proposal just because the documents were so different. So they still have to do their full review of these rules, and they'll come back with substantive comments. These rules definitely aren't perfect, but we can use the conditional approval process to make more tweaks to these rules. So you'll have a little bit more time to thoroughly read the rules and come up with any suggested edits that you might have. I also have Dan Fry on the phone. He should be on the call, and Lisa Hatz should be on the call. And they can answer specific program questions for you for any of the substantive changes.
Okay. All right. All right. Does anybody have any questions for Amanda?
Ann Lane.
Go ahead.
I don't have questions, but I do have some comments. On page 12, under Part ED 1006 Eligibility for Services B, B, read the end of the sentence. It's where it states, above an individual is presumed to have a goal of an employment goal.
It should be outcome. I'll change that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And then on page 14, under ED 1006.03, under A, it states that an individual is presumed to be eligible for vocational rehabilitative services. I wonder whether or not there needs to be clarification there that even though you're making the presumption because they have these other benefits, that they have either been or that they will be interviewed by a counselor or reviewed by a counselor, because throughout the rest of your rules, eligibility is all directly tied to a counselor having made an assessment. So that's the one place where I didn't see the counselor mentioned, and it seems that there needs to be more continuity. Unless it's implicitly implied, and that might be redundant, that if you're getting benefits from SSI or SSDI, that you've had this assessment.
So I think it could be that we could point this section to the rest of the eligibility requirements and the individualized plan for employment requirements, saying they still have to, you know, go through the process of the assessment and all that.
Yeah.
But can that be something that I can do in the conditional approval so I can make
Perfect.
Sure it's correct?
Okay. Yep. And then the other item that you and I spoke about with regard to referring back to a later section, also perfectly acceptable in the conditional approval.
Okay.
And that's all I have.
Thank you.
All right, anybody else?
There is one amendment that Drew and I made I wanted to point out. On page 13, it was...
It's 12 or 13. Let me check if it's 12.
Okay, so page 12A, there's a list of three requirements to be determined if you're eligible, and we discussed that one and two are redundant, so we removed one. So the proposal that you're going to be voting on actually has just two listed there, so two became one and three became two. So I just wanted to point that out, that has been edited.
And just to clarify, if you can't find page 12 quickly, for the eligibility, it listed three ways to be eligible. The first one was has a physical or mental impairment. The second one was has a physical or mental impairment, which constitutes or results in a substantial impediment to employment for the applicant. So you don't, with two being phrased the way it is, you don't need one. It's just duplicative. So we're just taking out one. And if there's no other discussion, we can entertain a motion.
Hi, Cindy Shagnon. I move that the State Board of Education approve the final proposal for ED 1000 Vocational Rehabilitation Programs as amended.
Ann Lane, second.
Roll call, Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagnon?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you.
Drew, right. may I ask Amanda a question?
Yeah.
Hi, Amanda. Ann Lane.
Hi.
I found it curious that at the end of this packet on page 45, it's Part ED 1019, New Hampshire Business Enterprise Program. I understand the connection, but it just seems really peculiar that this is under the Department of Education when it should be under, I don't know, Health and Human Services or Commerce or something.
Amanda, I can help.
Thank you. This is Dan Fry.
Hi, Dan.
Good afternoon. I am Daniel Fry. I'm the administrator of Services for the Blind and Vision Impaired, where the Randolph Shepherd program sits. Under the national Randolph Shepherd legislation that governs the program nationally, the rule requires that the Randolph Shepherd program be within the agency that provides rehabilitation services to people who are blind or vision impaired, no matter where that agency in state government sits. In various states, the rehabilitation agency is in different departments. Some states have it in labor, some states have it in education. But the rule requires that the Randolph Shepherd program reside in the VR agency that serves people who are blind and vision impaired. In some states, there's a VR agency that serves blind and vision impaired people alone as a state agency, and so the program would be there. In our state, we have a combined agency where we have a special office for the blind and a general services caseload as well, and so the Randolph Shepherd program resides within VR because VR is in education, if that's helpful, Ms. Lane.
Thank you very much. It is most helpful, and my confusion has been quelled.
Great. Glad to help.
Thank you.
All right. So next up is educator licensing. Amanda, would that be more you or Steve for that one?
It's just a straight adopt. These are the ED 500 overhaul.
Okay. You want to go ahead?
So yeah, Amanda, am I needed any further or no?
You're all set, Dan. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Have a nice day, everyone.
Thank you for coming.
Sure.
So the five rules for adoption are the ED 500. Four of them are the ED 500 overhaul. And then one of them is special education teachers. These were conditionally approved last month, and nothing has been changed since they were conditionally approved, and they're just ready for adoption. I do want to point out that because the new overhaul rules require some changes for our educator information system, the online EIS system, that in our letters that we submit when we adopt rules, we're asking the rules to not be effective until October 5th, which is right before the emergency rules for a couple of these expire, so that Steve's group can have some time to make all the changes necessary for EIS. But these are just straight adopt, and I put them all on one summary for you so you can adopt them all together. Any questions?
I'm happy to make a motion. This is Ann Lane.
Go ahead, Ann.
I move that the State Board of Education adopt ED 501-ED 504, ED 504. ED 505, ED 506, ED 508,
and ED-509, and ED-5112, and ED-5113, 513, New Hampshire Educator Licensing Rules.
Cindy Shagman, second.
Roll call. Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagman?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks. Okay, we're up to the commissioner's update.
Great. So I am here. Is everyone ready?
Yeah.
Good. Okay, just to, I have a variety of things, and then often you guys have some questions for us as well. I just thought I would give you some information in terms of how reopening is progressing and some of the experiences that we have kind of initially coming out of the box, since it's been a little bit of time since, you know, well, I guess the last time we talked, we were getting ready for opening, and now in many cases we are open. If you look across the system, about 36% of our school districts have opened for 5 days a week of instruction in person. About 42% are using some type of a hybrid model. Those hybrid models include alternating days, you know, like an A-B schedule where some students are in on Monday and Tuesday, some are in on Wednesday and Thursday, or on Thursday and Friday, something like that. Others, particularly in some of the smaller or the younger students, the hybrid model split the day, so they see the students every day, but they may see them for half of the day. Maybe they have a morning and an afternoon class. About 17% of the districts are remote, and then there's about 5% that we were still trying to wrap our hands around in terms of what it looked like, because that data that I just gave you was as of last week. So just some information for you. And I guess in terms of looking at the progress that we have there, I just wanted to share two stories with you, because I think our school systems have been working very hard to help facilitate, you know, the in-person instruction in a variety of different ways, as well as implementing a number of mitigating strategies. But we've had two circumstances that have come up since the opening that I think are they're good in terms of illustrating kind of the hard work and the effectiveness of good planning in all of our districts. We had one of our districts that was notified that some students had attended a camp and would potentially have been exposed to COVID, and were encouraged, those students were encouraged to be tested. That one of those students was in our instructional environment for an entire day. That was a Friday. The student was tested that day. The next day on Saturday, we got the test results for that student. We were able to, because we had good protocols in place, we were able to effectively execute contact tracing to understand who else might have been a close contact to that student. Having been through that, we were able to determine that there were no close contacts in that educational instructional environment that we had to isolate, and the community was notified on a Sunday, and on Monday we continued. We had continuity of learning, and kids showed up for school on Monday morning. So I just see that as a very positive, example of how well it all worked. Am I still online, by the way? Because it looks like we might have had a power surge here at the Department of Education.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, good. I just know my computer just crashed on me. So. another one was that took place was we had a circumstance where some educators had been potentially exposed. There was a student there was a gathering of educators that had some children with them as well. One of the children who had been at that gathering came down with some symptoms, went to their pediatrician. The pediatrician recommended COVID testing. And we did not have results back. So that happened on a Sunday that we knew about this symptomatic kid who was going to be tested. And so we were able to pivot an instruction environment to a remote instruction environment for Monday instruction. All of the teachers, all of the students knew their protocols, knew how to do it, pivoted to a remote instruction environment. Monday's instruction took place remotely. Partway through the day on Monday, we were notified that the COVID test was negative, and so there was not a risk. And on Tuesday, we were back in school. So another good example, and I think it's important that we recognize those because, you know, that is a reflection of the hard work and the planning that has taken place across all of our districts in terms of trying to, you know, effectively and creatively find ways to get us back to instruction.
Frank, if I could what do you mean by, do we have any more info on what is a gathering of educators?
It was an outside of the educational environment. So some teachers before school got together for a preschool party. I don't think there was anything malicious just happened, you know, but it's okay. Yeah. We worked through that and we're good. So the next thing that I kind of wanted to talk to you about was our ilearnnh.com that's the website, but ilearnnh is our learning management system that we are implementing. So we have had our first cohort of districts go through the initial setup of that system, which is really kind of the information technology level configuration of the system. That has already executed. This week we kicked off our second cohort. So we're running them in cohorts of getting them set up. And then once they get set up, then we continue to roll out those platforms to support our teachers, our students, and our families in the dynamic and nimble educational environments that I just described to you. To date, we have about 90,000 students that as we roll the program out will be covered, and we expect that more school districts will join in that process and make those tools available to be able to be used in those learning environments. But just to give you kind of a project update on that, we continue, and I know Steve is working hard on this, we continue to run trainings both for teachers, for families, for IT folks, for administrators to be able to be effective in that environment, including instructional design, including integration of various types of systems that schools may already have in place. And so that is and continuing to move forward. As many of you know, and we got a large ESSER grant, about $33 million available to our district schools that we made available to them to be able to absorb additional costs that may have been incurred in the district associated with COVID. Those grants were pushed out to the schools back in May, and schools are working through accessing those. About half of the schools have filled out a grant budget in terms of determining how they will deploy those funds. And we are, approving those and making that fund. So the funding's been accessible, once they get their budget input and approved. About $1 million of that funding has actually been spent so far. We did put out, I got to see if I can get my computer up. I had several documents on my computer I wanted to share with you. Then I'm just going to have to wing it a little bit. So we did issue Executive Order 64. And I know that we had the hearing on the remote instruction rule, and it sounded like we got a lot of good feedback on that. Executive Order number 64 was the additional rule amendment, really, through the executive order to be able to facilitate the remote instruction. And so that is out there and in place and will continue to allow our schools to have some flexibility in terms of how they continue to offer instruction to students. And another thing that I think is important for you to know about, I don't think we had this document available to you in our last meeting, but I think it's an important one that really needs to be ubiquitous across the state. But if you go to the department website, we have a 5 steps document, and we have also pushed that out into the social media sphere, which is, if there is a COVID incident in a school. It just lays out the five steps that take place when that happens so that everybody can be on the same page and everybody understands the process that we will be going through when that happens. And so the response is consistent across the state. And it's and again, from the examples that I shared, it sounds like it's a process that so far has been working well. And then I will also let you know that we received additional food and nutrition waivers last week from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that allows us to have our food program flexibility at least through December 31 of this year. And particularly around the area eligibility is one of the most important waivers that we were able to attain, and we did receive that. And so we continue to be able to service and support all of our students across the state. And I think I had some other things. Oh, okay. One other thing that I think would be important that I'll cover with you is, so we had, again, all the districts completed plans and they're reopening and they're going. As those plans were being completed, we went through the plans here at the department. We put together a team of folks to just kind of understand kind of how those plans were coming together, what are kind of the strengths and weaknesses, so that we were able to share those out with the districts. And so they could then, and we created a self-assessment tool that we shared out with the districts so that they could go back and really look at their plan and just look at their plan in the context of some of the feedback that we had relative to all the overall plans that we took a look at. Some of the strengths that we saw is the plans were very strong in terms of following the DHHS guidance. Lots of protocols were put in place around preparing the physical environment and how the physical movement of the students and the staff would be in there. And then there were a lot of other areas that they worked on. The areas that we saw that we wanted to make sure everyone was addressing completely were really around the communication plans, making sure that, we know who is supposed to be communicating with who and when and under what circumstances. In fact, that even came out in one of the instances that I described to you, in my conversation with the superintendent. They indicated that the communication plan worked well, but they saw that there were a couple of other people that they know they wanted to add to the list. And so just beefing up the communication plan was one area. And then the other is really just trying to be making sure that instructional environment is dynamic and nimble. And where that's really important is we spent a lot of time on this call talking about the VLACs and the option for VLACs. But really that nimbleness and that ability to ensure continuity instruction goes beyond just a VLACs solution. We have and will have circumstances where students present symptoms in our buildings. They may not be COVID, or they may be, but those students may find themselves in a circumstance of having to go home and quarantine themselves for potentially up to 14 days. And we want to make sure, and this is our objective, is that we have continuity of instruction for those students. So simply because they're at home doesn't mean we don't want them to continue to be able to engage in and participate in the instructional environment. And so that is just an area that a lot of the schools are working on to make sure that we can have that continuity of instruction. And I guess one more thing that I'll put out there is we also had applied, the feds have granted us the ability to, and we'll be sending in our waiver on this, for our 21C after school programming to allow flexibility. So typically the after school programming is not permitted to take place during the instructional hours of the school because it's supposed to be an after, so you find those either before or after school programming. But there's a waiver that we will be able to apply for that will allow those 21C programs to expand their hours of operation to be able to, and really where we see that happening is potentially support the communities with some remote learning centers or supervision for parents if a district is in a hybrid model and parents need to go to work and the students need a safe place to be able to access and engage their instruction. This will allow the flexibility for some of those 21C programs to flex and be able to do that. So those are some of the highlights of some of the stuff that's going on as we have opened. It's been a lot of activity going on, but I will pause and see if there are any questions folks have for me.
Any questions?
Commissioner, it's Kate.
Hi, Kate.
Hi. Hey, we've got two, this is a public hearing written testimony about the internet access. They were from Remote Learning. One was from Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
How are we doing with all of that? I guess people are having some problems.
So, I mean, I would say that the problems are not as acute as they were in the springtime, but there continue to be, you know, some families who are struggling with internet access, and so we are working to solve that. I can tell you about two cases that I was working on yesterday. Specifically, I know about the Londonderry one. I spoke with the parent, and so this was a financial circumstance that needed to be worked out. I did call to Comcast. You know, I don't know if it's completely been solved right now, but I know that the solution is in the works to be able to solve that problem for that student. And then there is, I'll share another example with you. I spoke with a family that they live in a rural area of our state. They have a half-mile-long driveway. They have no phone line to their home, so they don't have any kind of copper coming to their home. They have poor cellular reception no matter what carrier they have, and they were curious as to what the options were for internet. We talked about the satellite connectivity, but they also have a difficulty with the sky visibility. They don't have the southern visibility exposure, so they have a difficult time getting reliable satellite connectivity. So I will tell you that's one we don't have a solution to yet, other than making sure that the school building is open to that family so that if they're in a remote environment that that they can still come to the school to gain internet access at the school. But essentially what we're finding is that you have to work through the internet access issues one at a time. We continue to have, you know, discounted programs with our providers that are available to schools, and we share those with our you know, our school leaders so that they know that those programs are available out there. And we do know that there's direct-to-consumer marketing of those programs available also. But we just have to solve them one at a time because there will be some places in New Hampshire that don't have connectivity. I do think, I guess I will also point out that we did have the broadband project that was run through the Office of Strategic Initiative to build out additional broadband capacity in a number of communities. I think there's over 6,000 additional homes that will gain access to, you know, strong, reliable, high-speed internet access. You know, that will come online over time. Obviously, it's, you know, but it was a project that you'd want to see more of that happen, but the difficulty was that the funding stream for that had to actually be spent by December 30th. So there was a limited number of projects that could be implemented in that short time frame, but adding 6,000 homes is going to be great. There was a recent study that came out about internet connectivity across the country. New Hampshire ranks as, if not the top, one of the top states in terms of our capacity. But that's really meaningless if you're that household that doesn't have good access. So we need to continue to work to make sure that we can get all of our kids connected.
Did these two people here, one was Jessica Seeger, Corey Waters, do they go directly to their superintendent or their principal, or do they come, anybody with internet access problems goes right to you?
No, so oftentimes they will start with the their school district, and the school districts are solving these problems on a regular basis. But sometimes they may reach out directly to me and then I can intervene. Or sometimes it may be that I actually have a school system that will call me and say, you know, we have this household, this address that we're having difficulty getting connected. And the school system itself will ask me if I can help them get it connected, you know, thinking that perhaps because of the weight of the state reaching out to the provider, we have a little bit more leverage to try and get them to be responsive.
Okay, because I had a couple people call me, and I directed them to the principal and then to the superintendent. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions for the commissioner?
I'm all set, Drew.
Commissioner, do you have any other updates, any other thing to include?
No, that's all we've got.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank
you. That was a good update.
Good job with your computer going out.
I have to figure out what happened. I don't know what happened to my electricity.
Yeah, there was definitely a flicker of lights in here. So something went on. All right, so we have open board discussion right now. The first thing I want to throw out there is, and then we can open it up to more if anybody has anything else, but last meeting, Kate suggested doing a retreat to discuss charter schools and the rules changes and legal changes that we'd like to see. And I'm thinking about it, and I think that's a great idea for us all to get together and do a retreat just on charter school rules, invite some stakeholders in to have some presentations and to have a bigger discussion about this. And I don't think we're going to solve the whole issue and answer every question in the retreat, but it'll give us a really good direction, and we as a group can hash out what direction we want to go in. I just think that would be a really good exercise for all of us. So I had sent out some dates, and I got a little bit of feedback that September 30th was good for several people, but not necessarily for everybody. Cindy, you had suggested that the Wednesdays, Mondays wouldn't work for you.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm, one of Jean's assistants is out because her children, remote learning. And I just have to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I can't go on Monday to take the day.
Okay. well, let me work on Mondays and Wednesdays are actually good days for me, but I'll see what I can do to work out a different day. and I can send out some different dates. I'd like to get this done. If we can, in the next couple of weeks, I think that would be really doable.
Drew, could I ask a question?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, when I think of retreat, I think more of brainstorming, sharing ideas, philosophical, where do we want to be, and sort of, in this case, we have a broad range of charter schools that have raised some questions. There's a real practical experience of things that we have talked about wanting to look at. And that seems to me to be something we've got to address philosophically, programmatically, from a policy perspective, in the first instance. Where do we want to, what are the deficiencies we see? Where can they be addressed in rules or perhaps recommended legislation? If we could get consensus on that, that would seem to me to be huge and give us a roadmap for where we need to go. Because we have been talking about this and have had some, unfortunate experiences where we thought we don't have the tools we need to ensure that the kids are getting what they, what they should be getting through their experience and our relationship with what we can and can't do with charter schools for an issue. So when I read your email, I really saw it more as a, sitting down and writing some rules, and you'd even want them before the October meeting, maybe November. I feel like we need to start with gathering all of the places that we think we need to address and the problems that we've had, the deficiencies that we thought with respect, and then once we reach a consensus with us, with stakeholders, start to look at sort of a drafting. I think we have some work to do before drafting.
Okay, well, thank you. I don't think there's I don't think this is an either-or situation. As I tried to explain before, we've been
needing to talk about this for a long time. The retreat is an opportunity for us to do that, to set our, to as a group, do just what you lay out. Decide what our philosophy is on this, decide what policy direction we want to go in. We're going to have that discussion. And if we do an all-day retreat, I see no reason why we can't be in the process of beginning to sketch out some rules by the end of that day. I don't see a conflict there. I think it's some, you know, you do a retreat, you can do both.
Drew?
Yep.
Hi, this is Cindy. I would, if we are doing this, I would love to not be on the phone. I would like, I think a retreat, we need to be in the same room. I would love, you know, downstairs is at room 15, I think, where I know the Teacher of the Year Committee met, and that room's big enough we can easily spread out and get 6 feet apart from each other. I just think if we're going to do a retreat, let's do it together.
I agree. I would, that would be my goal. So if we can all, I will look for a room that would allow us to do that.
Yeah.
Hi, Drew. It's Kate.
Hey, Kate.
Alan, well, everybody, because we, as the state, as the board, not a lot of people are reformed, updated. Charter schools are new to them. The laws are different. You know, that first meeting, I wanted to make sure that, you know, it's like right down, do we have all the job descriptions? I wanted Jane to be there to make sure that one package that goes out to somebody is consistent. We've got 10 different things going on, same package, and everybody's got a different finance budget. And we will get to those rules and those laws, but we do need to do some organization. And Jane's done a wonderful job. But there are other things. And to start there, so everybody understands what charter is all about. So, you know, we almost sometimes get to start from the beginning, and by the end of the day, we'll, you know, we can chart our next meeting, because it's going to be more than one or two meetings. But I think we need to all understand what charter is about. Does the state, you know, being a little bit more involved in visiting their facilities. I think there's a lot, and I think that first committee meeting, we're going to have a lot of questions. Because I see a lot of inconsistency. So that's my put on, and what I want is to everybody to be informed what charter, you know, the process, and Jane's done a great job. We're getting the process. We're eliminating things. We're trying to be consistent, and we're doing great at that. But that's why I wanted that retreat. I wanted the laws, all of those rules be consistent and to everybody to understand, you know, what charter is all about and why we have separate rules and just different things. And in between here and the next date, I'm sure everybody will think of a lot of different questions, like the job descriptions. You know, probably to some people that's not serious, but I've seen what it can do to people. But anyways, just different things. Just, you know, and I think eventually we'll, you know, get onto the rules, the laws, we'll accomplish something, but that first committee meeting is with a lot of questions and see where we go from there. Am I wrong?
No, not necessarily. So, you know, my thinking on this is that over the last year, we as a board have identified a lot of serious issues with the charter school rules. The staff have been working on this. They've done a great deal of work. And if you remember from last month's meeting, when we had the initial proposal for the charter school rules that we were revising, the staff has done a tremendous amount of work. We already have identification of, again, this is a beginning. So this is what I want us to discuss at the retreat. So we already have laws that are identified as creating problems that we would need to, as a board, discuss those laws, see what we want to do about them. What do we as a board want to recommend to the legislature to change? And what do we not want to do? So that's one thing we need to tackle. we have already identified a lot of deficiencies in the rules when it comes to the initial application. We're beginning to work on those. We have deficiencies in the rules as regarding to renewals big deficiencies with renewals. So that's so if you're going to break it down, we've got laws, application, renewals, and then oversight. So what happens when a charter school is in violation of the rules or the law? What sort of oversight, what sort of procedures? So that's the other group of our issue that we've determined needs to be addressed. So staff has already been working on those as groups, and that's at the direction of the board. Those are all things the board has over time identified as needing to be worked on. So a lot of the groundwork for a retreat has already been done in terms of sketching out, identifying the areas that need to be addressed. And then what I'm envisioning for this retreat, and I'm welcome anybody's input on this, is we will have presentations by staff on these key issues broken down, and we will tackle them and have an open discussion as a board on each of those categories. What do we? What is our vision for this? How do we want to recommend the state go? And then in that discussion process, I think it's enough legwork has been done already that it's my aspiration that we could begin to sketch out some rule changes. Now, I don't assume we will have fully drafted rules done by the end of that day, but if we can begin the process on sketching out big, in a big picture what we want to see, I think it's not unreasonable for the staff to run with that and come back at the next regular board meeting with some potential draft language or initial rules. We may not take that up at the next board meeting and do a full initial rule proposal. We may, you know, say, look, it needs to be tinkered with. We need to revise it. Let's wait and not introduce it. But I want to get moving on that process so we're not waiting any longer. And that's my goal, is to come out of this retreat really moving forward. And but we need to have that retreat type of discussion together as a group, I think, so we know where we as a group want to go. So that's kind of my vision. So I think it incorporates a lot of Helen's ideas for setting out a strategic vision of where we want to go. And then hopefully we can end with some beginnings of the tactical stuff. So so that's what I'm thinking. Cool. And we'll have staffers from the department, so I'll need their input on when they're available. We want to get charter school administrators there. We want to get, you know, folks who have some inside knowledge of how the rules apply, actually work on the ground, and get their feedback. So it's going to be a lot of info, and we're not going to have fully completed product by the end of the day, but it really is going to get us moving forward. That's the thought.
When do you think? Go ahead, Helen.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. So, Drew, just when we have had retreats in the past on this board, one of the things that were done is that the chair and commissioner would send out an email to the board members, what are the issues you want to hear about, so that they could identify the appropriate presenters from staff. And I think that would be helpful. I think it would be, just off the top of my head, thinking about Caitlin and Nate, maybe Chris, with our experience with one of the charter schools, certainly Jane, perhaps Matt Southerton, just... so that we can have categories addressed. And Jill Perlow had talked to us on a number of occasions about, here's my concern with what you want to do and the rules you may need to think about. And it would be very helpful to have our council be able to say, you know, given some of the things, the problems you've run into, the issues you wanted to tackle, here are some categories that I think you need to seek more authority, clarify the rules, whatever. I think there are a number of those that, I mean, you may think staff are going ahead and doing a number of things, and that's probably true. I know that they are, they're certainly listening to all the things we've had to say, I think a broader knowledge base for all of us, because this has been an issue that's been going on for a long time, and I think we run into problems every time. No, you know, you really can't do that, and here's why. So that we can firm up our knowledge base and then be able to come up with the areas. I'm not going to, believe me, I am the last one to want to delay anything in this. You know, I have a sense of urgency. But I think if we move right to rules or trying to do rule writing without having all the information that all of us probably need and a thorough understanding, I think Kate's speaking to some of that.
Helen, can I just, I'm sorry, but maybe I just should be a lot more detailed and specific and give exact names and job titles, but when I said staff and stakeholders repeatedly in all the emails that I've sent out in the last meeting and in this meeting, when I've said that over and over and over again, I just thought it was understood that I was talking about the charter school staff and the people who oversee charter schools and not people who are unrelated to charter schools in the department. So obviously we will invite Nate and Jane and Caitlin. They have to be there. They are the ones who've been drafting all of the, been working on all of the rules and laws. And I mean, I just assume that was understood. And of course we have to have an attorney there. So Chris, Kate, Nate, Jane, I'm sorry, Caitlin, Nate and Jane, will all have to be there.
What about Jill, who had advised a number of times?
Jill, I will invite Jill, but Jill is, in case you haven't noticed, Chris has been the attorney who's been working with us most closely because Jill has been overwhelmed with COVID-related work at the AG's office. So she has not been as available to us. So obviously I'll invite Jill, but I'm not certain she'll be able to commit the time to be there.
Okay.
But Matt Southerton obviously has to be invited. We don't want to exclude that group. I would anticipate inviting charter school directors, and I'm absolutely happy to take suggestions for other folks who would come, but obviously, we're not going to do this in the dark without input from staff and folks in the field. I mean, I just thought that was pretty clear from the beginning. So, again, it's a retreat that all the board has input on. So if anybody has any issues they want to address, by all means, send them to me. That's the way these things work. So maybe I should have made that more clear in the beginning. But I just thought that was understood, that that's how retreats work.
Okay, so let's do this. Drew, I'm going to push you a little. Can we get a date named by either Friday or Monday or a place?
I would hope Monday. I'm not sure we can do it by Friday because I've got to coordinate with all those named staff people. And and I want to invite some – I haven't sent invitations out because I wanted to get a agreement by the board to do the retreat first. So obviously there are some charter school practitioners that we want to invite to give their input as well.
Yep.
So, I wouldn't be able to get one by tomorrow, but I will get on that this afternoon and see if we can nail down a date very, very soon. It cannot be Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So we are looking at either a Thursday, Friday, or Saturday date. I would hope not to not do it on Saturdays. If we can swing that, is there anybody that's not okay with a Thursday or Friday?
It depends on which one, Drew. I can't tell you for sure. I have some religious holidays coming up that start in the evening on Friday night of next week, and so it really just depends on when we're...
Yeah, I did notice that, Helen, so the holidays...
It's the Jewish holiday busy time. I'm sorry. It's sort of like Christmas to New Year's, and... just a really difficult time to have extra time out of the office. If there was any chance we could move this to the beginning of October, it would be easier for me. But, I recognize that that's not everybody's issue.
So, Helen, just to be clear, if we could do it in, I doubt we could pull it off this quickly, but say the week of September 21st through 25th or the week of the first full week of October. Would either of those be good for you?
That 25th, the Jewish New Year starts that evening, so that's a really hard day for me.
Okay.
So, and then what, the next week, you said?
The next week would be the first full week of October. So after, so the week of the 5th through the 9th, before Columbus Day weekend. So we probably wouldn't want to do it Friday the 9th because that's the, I imagine some of you will be heading out or staff will be heading out for Columbus Day weekend.
Drew, so, why don't you do it on Thursdays?
If we did a Thursday, October 8th, or Thursday, September 24th, maybe something like
October
that.
October 8th, our board meeting.
Drew, this is Frank. If I just can add a dimension to this conversation, because there's a lot of staff that are named in this.
Yep.
You know, we are at the department, you know, because we're reopening and we have a lot going on here, and we have to make sure that we're available to support those schools. So we're
sure.
going to need more lead time than a couple of weeks to be able to carve an entire day out of the school, out of the work week for folks
okay.
to be able to properly support you. So I just
okay.
want to mention that because it's just not possible. Like everybody's going 150 miles an hour. I mean, I know you talked about, you know, Caitlin, as an example, we are doing our, you know, we get all, in October, first week of October, we get all of our census data in, and we have to crunch all that
gotcha.
Stuff so we get the tax rate setting done. And so there's a lot happening right now, and we have openings at the department that we can't fill because, you know, we have some budget issues at the state level, and I think that that needs to be considered. So.
Okay, so you're screwing with my plans, man. All right, so maybe we do sometime in the last 2 weeks of October then. If we can think about that.
I think that's a much better idea, yeah.
Okay. All right, so maybe we'll think about
the
– yeah, if everybody – the 22nd and 29th of October, those are Thursdays, and the 23rd and 30th, those look like potential days.
I can reschedule, so I can – I just couldn't do the 21st because of the MRI, but I can manipulate
okay.
my schedule. For you. So I'm cool.
All right. Well, everybody check for those 4 days, and then I'll talk to staff, and we'll make some phone calls and get some charter school folks and see what we can do with that date range.
So what were the 4 dates you just gave us?
October 22nd and 23rd, or the 29th, or the 29th and 30th.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you. I'll check.
All right. Okay, so any other discussion on that?
No. I'm cool.
Nope.
Nope. Okay. Anything else? Anybody have any issues you want to bring up?
Yes, I had my hand raised before. This is Helen. I'm wondering what the next step is with the draft rules regarding remote instruction that we had the hearing on today.
Yes.
Minimum standards, we had gotten some written comments. We had gotten some oral testimony today. And Angela is going to send us the writing for Carl Ladd. What is the next step in terms of gathering that information together, looking at the impact? What will happen? And I imagine Amanda is not there now, but, you know, there was some substantive thing. It was good information. What's going to happen now?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm not I don't have a firm answer for you because I think we have a couple of different things to consider with these rules. And I do consider what we put out there as a rough draft that, you know, I think it was always understood we would need a lot of feedback and would anticipate making changes to those. So we have very different proposals. So the School Administrators Association's proposal was very different than the School Board Association's proposed changes. They actually proposed doing it in a totally different section of rules. So we have those two. And then we have the governor's emergency order, which he did after we proposed these rules. And his is, I think, if I remember correctly, it's more similar to the School Boards Association's proposal. So I think I'd like to get Chris's opinion and maybe Amanda and kind of look through how we would address these issues. And I think we're going to have a lot more conversations with people. So we have some time on these, on this particular proposal. I don't think it, I think it runs through November. But I think we got to just do a lot more talking to people and a lot more working on angles that we hadn't considered, kind of the unanticipated consequences of them. And, you know, come back maybe in a meeting, maybe in October, you know, with some revision, because I don't think anybody is suggesting that we can move forward with these without making some changes to them. And some of the changes that were suggested are very different. It would actually involve not doing this particular proposed rule, but writing the remote instruction into a different set of rules or a different section of the rules. So
that was,
I think
the association seemed to be suggesting that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know sometimes Amanda gathers the voices together and tries to see where there are commonalities, where there are, you know, what possibly can be resolved. And I just wondered what our next, and I wasn't even aware that the governor's, shame on me, that the governor's emergency order was different than sort of what we're suggesting. So we do have a lot to reconcile, and just wondered what next steps would be.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I've got to discuss with staff and with the attorneys and probably with some of the stakeholders too, and just talk this through a little more. And it may be, I'm just off the top of my head here, but we want to get these rules right. So we proposed these, if you remember, the initial proposal was made well before the governor had made his order for the fall. So we had thought we would have to get something in place this fall. and we have a little bit more time because we have an emergency order in place now. But I just think we got to take a look at all the different proposals we have, take a look at the governor's order, and do some thinking and some collating here and seeing what the best approach would be. And then bringing something back for a, you know, another discussion at the board level as to what we want these to look like. So it's not a cut and dried thing where we can say, oh, look, we can plug in a few changes here and a few changes there. I mean, I think the options here go in a couple of different directions that would require drafting a couple of different types of rules. And I don't know where we want to go. So it may be the case that we talk to Amanda and talk to some other folks and come up with two different proposals for the board to discuss and decide which one we like. I'm just not sure. But I think we have a lot of discussion to do in the next few weeks.
Okay. And if any other comments come in, I'm sure they'll be forwarded to us, which would be helpful. I would like us to address the question about an unfunded mandate that Carl raised too. And so, I mean, not to just pull that one out, he raised a lot of things. I think we need to feel confident one way or the other on whatever we propose that it is not an unfunded mandate.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Helen. Anybody else? Any other topics of discussion?
I'm good.
Okay. All right, so consent agenda. Did anybody have any changes to the meeting minutes? I had a few. Angela, are you there?
I am here.
Okay, so on page 4990 of the minutes.
Okay.
Let me see if I can actually open the minutes again. I can't seem to find them.
Let me scroll down to that.
I think I closed them. If you go down to that page, at the end of one of the paragraphs, before it quotes me, it says I quoted from statute, but I was quoting from rule, not statute.
I think it's stated he then read from the statute and it should be read rule.
Correct.
Correct. All right.
And on 4992, in the discussion between Helen and I, it said that I retorted. And I thought that was too strong a word. I would like to change it to responded.
Done.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah. Ann Lane. I'm looking for the page, but it was regarding our discussion of what was termed by me a burden on charter schools to supply information about performance, I think. And my intentions were lost in translation. Just trying to find where that is.
I think it's page 4983.
4983. Let's see. Yeah, I'm not sure how to change it. I just that it came across that I didn't value the information that was being supplied, and I do, and I did.
okay.
But that I did not want to burden charter schools with something that public schools we collected automatically. And I've since learned that we collect the same information about the charter schools automatically. So I really don't know how to change it. I just, for the record, wanted to say that I certainly think it's valuable.
I think you were just pointing out a potential equity issue. You wanted the charter schools treated fairly with the traditional public school. That's my recollection.
That's correct. Yes. But how you insert that, I don't know. Use your magic. I mean,
I'll see what I can do.
Thank you.
Any other changes? All right, so then we have the Hollis Brookline. Oh, do you want to do the meeting separate or just do, if anybody has nothing with the Hollis Brookline Cooperative School District certification of new apportionment formula, we can do them both at the same time.
Yes,
nobody has
Cindy.
Anything on that? Okay. Okay, go ahead, Cindy.
I move that we approve the consent agenda as amended.
Ann Lane, second.
I apologize, but for some reason, everybody faded out when the motion was made. So if you don't mind repeating it, just for the record.
Sure. Cindy, I move that we approve the consent agenda as amended.
And Ann Lane, second.
And,
thank you.
And the, well, not just the consent agenda, but also the...
That includes minutes and the Hollis Brookline.
Okay. So the whole consent agenda, not just the minutes, right?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, roll call.
Sally Griffin,
okay.
Yes. Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Cindy Shagnon?
Yes.
Helen Otero?
Yes.
Drew Klein.
Abstain. All right. Motion to adjourn?
Cindy, I move we adjourn.
Second, Helen.
Helen got the second.
Helen. All right. Roll call. Sally Griffin.
Yes.
Ann Lane.
Yes.
Kate Cassidy.
Yes.
Cindy Shagman.
Yes.
Helen Honoreau.
Yes.
Drew Klein.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day, everybody.
Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Danielle.